This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. This week, Miami Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton lent her voice and her family to an effort that represents a bit of a political risk-taking for the Republican, transgender rights.
Every transgender person is part of someone's family and should be treated with compassion and protected from discrimination. Family is about acceptance and love. All of our children should have the opportunity to work hard, earn a living, and take responsibility for their lives on the same terms as everyone else.
The Congresswoman's son is now 30 years old. He started living as a transgender male in college. Congresswoman Ross-Layton's break with her party's stance on transgender issues extends beyond public service announcements, however. She supports the Obama administration's directive out this past week to public schools that they must allow students to use bathrooms that matches their gender identity, even if that is different than their anatomical gender. For instance, a student who's born a male but identifies as a female would use the girls' bathroom and play on girls' sports teams. The directive from the White House does not have the force of law, but it comes with the threat of money. Schools that don't comply could lose federal money under Title IX, which bans discrimination in education programs based on sex. So let's begin the Florida Roundup this week there with gender, public schools, and bathrooms. Do you support all gender restrooms? Should they be required in public schools? Beyond the politics, has transgender equity impacted your neighborhood, your family? Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. You can find us on social media, on Facebook, and on Twitter. Look for us at WLRN. Let's start with Brandon Larrabee, who covers Tallahassee in the state of Florida for our partner, News Service of Florida, with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Brandon, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. What has been the Florida regulatory reaction in the past week since receiving this letter from the Obama administration last Friday?
Well, when you talk, if you're talking about officials like Governor Rick Scott and the Florida Department of Education, they have largely tried to stay mum on this issue. They've said that they're reviewing the order. They have not come out with a definitive statement one way or the other. There have been some governors elsewhere who have said they will defy the guidance from the U.S. Department of Education, but Scott has stayed away from that, even though some social conservatives have pressured him to do the same.
And you talk about guidance, and that's exactly what this is. As we mentioned, this is not the force of law, federal law coming down to the states, but the force of guidance. But there is significant leverage here, which are federal dollars for Title IX programs. Any idea how much is at stake for the state of Florida or any individual school district should they decide to ignore the guidance from the Obama administration?
Well, it's not – I don't know that there's a clear dollar figure. It's in the hundreds of millions of dollars and probably north of $1 billion. Basically, any federal funds would be endangered if a school district was found out of compliance with Title IX and the federal government chose to take it that far. For the most part, the federal government has not done that in the past. Mm-hmm. They've worked with districts to try to find some way for the districts to get themselves into compliance as opposed to actually using the leverage of taking that money away.
We did hear from one state representative this week in North Florida, Janet Adkins. She's the chair of an education subcommittee in the Florida House. She's also running for a superintendent position in North Florida. She wrote a letter over this past weekend to the Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. What did she write to the AG?
Well, she called the guidance intrusive. She argued that it may violate the 10th Amendment, which gives states a claim of sovereignty.
States' rights, right, sure.
Right. And basically she asked for Bondi to declare whether in the Attorney General's office they thought that this was a violation of the Constitution or of Florida's rights as a sovereign state. And Bondi's people sent back a very brief letter saying, we don't interpret federal law, and that was that. Bondi is very much like Rick Scott so far, trying to kind of stay out of this issue.
Yeah, and how atypical is that for the AG's office, first of all, to be asked for guidance on a federal policy or a federal guidance coming in, and secondly, for the essentially the top prosecutor in the state of Florida to say we don't provide guidance on federal law?
The first part of it, it's not frequent that the Attorney General gets asked for an opinion like that. It's not unprecedented, but it's not frequent. I couldn't really quantify – because it's not frequent, yeah. I couldn't really quantify. It's generally more the Attorney General is asked for opinions on state law rather than federal law.
Brandon Larrabee covering the state of Florida for our partner News Service of Florida, talking about transgender rights and the policy coming in from the Obama administration within the past 7 days, discussing transgender equity and equality at public schools. The leader of the second largest public school district in the state of Florida, one of the top five largest public school districts in the entire United States, joins us now. Superintendent Robert Runcie is the head of the Broward County Public School. Superintendent Runcie, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to hear from you, sir.
Yes, glad to be here. Good afternoon.
Will Broward schools comply with the White House order received last week?
Absolutely. And what I will tell you is this, that Broward schools and the guidelines and processes that we put in place, we've already been complying. I think Broward has, for the last couple of years, has been working through a number of areas in order to create equitable and safe learning environments for all of our students, regardless of their race, their background, their sexual orientation, or their gender affinity. So we actually have things in place, and this new piece that's come out from the White House is really not going to change what we've already been doing.
Have you been doing such things that are addressing the utilization of restroom facilities and locker room facilities?
Yes, absolutely. We have guidance on that, and we're in the process of continuing to provide ongoing training and support to our schools. And in fact, in a couple of weeks, we're going to provide an update to our guidelines in this area.
Could you give us a sneak peek?
Yes.
Could you give us a sneak peek, maybe, Superintendent?
Yes. So when you look at a school, the way this works, a student that's transgender status, the way the process works, we would have a conversation in the school, typically with them and their parent and guardian. We would talk about the situation and find a way to accommodate their needs. And that could be through unisex bathrooms we have in schools. It could be through staff facilities and others. So we have a variety of options in the school to be able to accommodate the students. But I mean, in no way do we just, you know, totally deny their right to use the facility, but we have options that we work through that make it comfortable for the student and also respects the rights of the other students in the school facility.
Some of the methods that are mentioned in the White House directive from last week talk about privacy, use of privacy curtains in restrooms, and allowing students to change clothes in bathrooms instead of locker rooms. Has Broward County Schools utilized any of those methods?
You know, not at the moment. We haven't run across that. But again, all of these things are handled on a case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't just one standard way to say, hey, this is how we're going to treat all of our transgender students. You know, we really try to customize the situation for each and every student. And again, we've been doing this for quite some time now. Have not run into any real issues at any of our schools around this, you know, have not handled.
So give us Superintendent Runcie, give us an idea of how many schools have used these policies and how many years has Broward Schools had these policies in place?
We have a resource guide, LGBTQ resource guide that we have issued since 2012. It's been a model for other districts who have consulted with us. So I'd say for about four or five years now, we have been down this path of working to make sure that we have processes, procedures, training, and support in place. We have a department that actually works with our schools in this area and provides guidance and counseling to parents and administrators when they come across students that are LGBTQ.
Superintendent Runcie, there's a state representative, Janet Adkins, who is a elected official now, wants to become an elected superintendent in North Florida. She has called this directive from the White House intrusive. How do you respond to that? Is it an intrusive directive from the federal government, or is it something else?
You know, I don't see it as being intrusive from Broward County's perspective because, again, we already have some guidelines in place. In fact, it's called our Procedures for Transgender Students Need Safety and Resiliency. Again, we've already put that in place. In some ways, you know, we can look at the federal guidelines and even think that they might be in some ways even incorporating some of the things that we have here.
Did you ever have discussions with the White House, Superintendent?
No, not about this particular topic, but I will tell you this is something that we've been working on for a while. We've made it readily available to other school districts and folks around the state and anyone else that would inquire. So, you know, we're pretty proud of what we've been able to do here. If we look at things like locker rooms or bathrooms, specifically what, you know, we put in place, we give our transgender students, they have access to locker rooms that corresponds with their gender identity at the school. And again, we work through it in a way that we respect the needs of all students. So, for example, in a locker room, they may have use of a private area in a locker room. We sometimes actually can accommodate a separate changing schedule for the students, or we actually have a nearby private area. It could be a restroom. It could be an office restroom. It could be a health office restroom. So we work with, again, in each school, and we do it on a case-by-case basis through dialogue with the student, their parent, and the leadership at the school so that we can create a safe and supportive learning environment for everyone in the school. And that's worked well. That's been our philosophy, and we're going to continue down that path.
Superintendent Robert Runcy here joining us, the head of the Broward County Public School District, on the Florida Roundup, talking about transgender equity and equality. A week after the Obama administration and the White House issued a directive regarding public schools and transgender access to programs and bathrooms, for instance. Join the conversation here, 800-743-9576. A sensitive topic, yes, but one that the community here is discussing in South Florida. Let's go to Miami, and Jason is joining us from Line 1. Go ahead, Jason.
Hi. I agree wholeheartedly that a person should use the bathroom that fits their gender identity. I mean, my sister is lesbian, and I have countless LGBT friends. But what I don't agree with is a person, well, mainly somebody who transitions from male to female, playing on female sports teams if they've transitioned after puberty, because they obviously have an unfair advantage.
Being the hormonal difference between the two genders. Let me put that to Superintendent Runcy. Have you run into a access of gender identity and athletic involvement?
No, I don't recall any particular cases. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been one in Broward that's been handled, but I'm not aware of any that has risen to a level of concern that I've seen so far. So I'm not aware of it, but that would be something for me to go back and look at.
Let's join Lima from Sunrise, who's with us on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, Lima.
Hi. I was just calling to make a statement about the whole transgender issue. This fear of allowing transgender people into public restrooms, I believe it's stemming from a confusion about gender identity and sexual orientation. If the fear is that, you know, transgender people, they're going into these bathrooms, they might not be sexually attracted to other people in the bathroom, which was the same argument used against homosexuals way back when. And another issue, just this morning in the news, I was reading about this female person who had experienced transphobia. So now, because she looked masculine, so now we have a situation that's just growing to the point where it's now affecting persons who might appear masculine or feminine, but are in fact male or female. So that's, I think that this whole this confusion about gender identity and sexual orientation is just feeding into transphobia, where it's now affecting people who are not a part of that issue.
Lima, we appreciate you adding your perspective there. In Tamarack in Broward County, Sarah joins the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, Sarah. You with us here? Let's try this line here. Go ahead, Sarah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, yes. What my concern and issue is that I just want to know, can they just build another bathroom specifically for transgenders? Because my concern is that, you know, I'm not against people who are trans. You know, I mean, my late brother died, you know, years ago. He was, you know, he was in a gay lifestyle. And but my main concern is that, you know, for young women who are going to go use the restroom, and let's say some guy, you know, who is not, you know, a transgender says, oh, hey, now I can use, you know, the girl's locker room, mm-hmm. or the girl's bathroom. And, you know, because you know, they're saying, the laws are saying that, you know, hey, if you feel like, you know, you're a woman, you know, you can go into the girl's restroom.
Sarah, got it. Yeah, that's scary. A common criticism here. Superintendent Runcie, you've been dealing with this similar issues here for at least, by your estimation, 3 or 4 years. Have you run across those criticisms, I imagine. How have you dealt with them?
Well, let me just say this. There aren't any situations that, you know, I'm aware of, and this is a common thing that we hear out there, so I appreciate that caller mentioning it, but there aren't situations where a young man's going to just say, hey, I'm transgender today, and run in the girls' bathroom. That's not how it works, right? So students, first of all, they have to identify themselves as transgender, and then there's consultation that goes on with the transgender student and their parents or guardian to discuss the topic, and then a customized approach is worked through with the student. And again, we have multiple options in the school that we talk through, right? And that could be, again, other types of facilities, alternative facilities such as single stall, gender neutral restrooms. We have office restrooms, staff restrooms. We have health offices. We have a variety of circumstances and opportunities in the school to address the needs of that student. But it's not where students are going to just randomly make decisions that they're transgender today and go into a bathroom or a locker room. That's not how it works.
Superintendent Robert Runcie, Brandon Larrabee from News Service of Florida with us still from Tallahassee. Go ahead.
Oh, well, one of the things I was going to say, your caller had mentioned the possibility of separate restrooms.
Building separate restrooms
for transgender folks. The guidance from the federal government pretty much said
you can't do that.
You can right. allow students who want an alternative restroom facility, a private restroom facility, to have access to one if the district can. But you can't say that transgender students have to use their own restroom.
Superintendent Robert Runcie, again, leader of the Broward County Public School District. Go ahead, sir. Your final thoughts.
Yeah. So, yeah, you can't say that. And what you do, though, again, you have to customize this. So let's, you know, back up and look at this.
Let me ask you just one other quick question here, because you've used this customization characterization multiple times. What's the estimate of transgender students that the Broward County Public Schools have had this customization plan addressed toward?
I don't know the number, but I will tell you it's relatively small at mm-hmm. this time. Our total LGBTQ population is about 12 or 13% of the student body, which, again, that's not transgender. That's the total.
So that's 25,000?
That have identified themselves right. in that group. But there's not 25,000 transgender students. I don't know what that specific number is, but it is relatively small in Broward County, very small.
Superintendent, we'll let you go. Thank you for your time today on the Florida Roundup. All Superintendent right. Robert Runcie right. is the head of the Broward County Public School District. Brandon Larrabee with our partner News Service of Florida. I want to bring this back to state regulators here, Brandon, in Tallahassee, because this attention on this issue has certainly come because of the White House directive from last week, which followed after a North Carolina law received a lot of criticism, banning people from using bathrooms that don't match their birth gender. Clearly, we're not in a legislative session right now. Legislators are in election or re-election mode. But any sense that a similar measure could be taken up by Florida lawmakers in the next session?
Well, there actually was a similar bill taken up in 2015. It was a House bill. It didn't get passed. I think it passed the second House committee, but it never actually made the House floor. There was no real interest in taking it up last year. I think a lot of people, given the shifting opinions on LGBT issues over the last 5 or 10 years, are just kind of trying to see how this settles out before they do anything like that.
Brandon Larrabee with News Service of Florida. Thanks so much. Nice to hear from you again, Brandon. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on the Florida Roundup, some presidential politics in the Sunshine State, the fight between Democrats and a Florida strategist goes with Trump. That's all next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Tom Hudson here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening this week. Presidential politics in Florida now. This week, the Trump campaign hired a former top strategist for Governor Scott, and there are new calls for South Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz to resign as head of the DNC, Democratic National Committee, as she butts heads with one of her party's presidential hopefuls. All of this as a Quinnipiac University poll shows Florida, it's a toss-up. If it's Trump versus Clinton, placing even more importance on this swing state's swing vote, the Latino vote. Let's get into all of it. James Rosen is Washington, D.C. correspondent with McClatchy Miami Herald, John Kennedy with the Palm Beach Post with us from Tallahassee, and Tim Padgett covering Latin issues for us here at WLRN. James Rosen, explain, first of all, this friction that is growing red hot between the Democratic National Committee and the Bernie Sanders campaign, and it seems to be centered on a Broward County Congresswoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who, of course, is the chair of the DNC.
Right. Tom, this goes back many months into last year. There have been a number of previous episodes. It actually goes back at least until 2008 when Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz was co-chairperson of Secretary Clinton's first presidential campaign in, against President Obama in the Democratic primary. The two of them, according to a number of prominent Floridians and Miamians that I've talked to on background, are extremely close friends. They align. Obviously, there's the gender alignment, but they also align on a number of political and personal issues. They're very close. So you start with that foundation. And then there was a flap last year over it may have been early this year over Senator Sanders' access to a Democratic Party database mm-hmm. of voters. It was cut off for several days. He was very upset about that. Later on, there was disagreement over the number of debates to be scheduled. He wanted more debates. She wanted fewer debates. And at first, Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz was not scheduling very many debates. Sanders supporters thought that was in deference to
Hillary. And the debates that were being scheduled on holiday weekends or on Saturday nights. That was their complaint.
Right. You would not have a large audience.
Yeah. So, James, bring us to this week, last week in Nevada. It was a Democratic caucus, which is a process. It's not just an evening. But there were accusations of Sanders supporters not only getting out of hand, being verbally abusive, but being physically threatened. And the Democratic National Committee and Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz had some strong words and were very critical of Senator Sanders and thinking that Sanders didn't go far enough in his condemnation of that behavior.
Well, I wrote a long article about this a couple of days ago, mm-hmm. and I talked with a number of people involved. The problem is that the facts are somewhat in dispute. Since my article ran, in which I quoted folks and local news reports from Las Vegas, including very well-established political reporters who've reported there for years. I described chairs being thrown. Yep. And then, most importantly, this was at the Nevada Democratic Party state convention. The chairwoman of that party, Roberta Lane, later reported getting her mm-hmm. cell phone number and email address were posted on social media, and she reported getting over 1,000 very threatening yeah. and sexist yeah. messages.
Some death threats. Emails. Death threats against her and her family, her children.
Yes, and death threats. But since my article ran, I have heard from Sanders supporters around the country It's interesting. None of them were at the convention, but they all claim to know people who were at the convention.
Yeah.
And they've all told me that there were no chairs thrown, there were no death threats, et cetera, et cetera. And I've said, look, if you put me in touch with people who were there so I can interview them,
right,
I'll be glad to write a follow-up article.
So some of the facts here are in dispute, but what is not in dispute is this tension, obviously, that has been existing, as you've mentioned, between the chairperson of the Democratic National Committee and one of the campaigns of her presidential party hopefuls. John Kennedy, I want to bring you in now with the Palm Beach Post with us from Tallahassee. Debbie Wasserman Schultz has enjoyed some significant popularity in Broward County and northern Miami-Dade County, which is where her congressional district is. But she also faces a primary challenge this election cycle from an international trade law professor at NSU. Is her behavior with the DNC and the criticism and the tension that her presence at the DNC is generating reflecting upon her primary opponent here in any way, shape, or form, do you think?
Well, I don't really think so. She's in a pretty secure district where I think she's kind of a known candidate. She's somebody who has sort of risen up the ranks in Broward politics from being a legislative aide in the Florida legislature to where she is today. And I think she's kind of a known quantity there that, my supposition would be that she would not really face a very stiff challenge.
Yeah. Her opponent has certainly raised a pretty decent amount of money for an untried political opponent. I want to bring it back to the national level now with you, James Rosen. What about her future with the Democratic National Committee? It has come under the microscope often. It has come under the microscope and pressure earlier in this election cycle. Will she retain the chairmanship position through November?
Oh, I don't foresee any scenario where she would not retain that position. This was a personal assignment from President Obama. It was a four-year assignment. It's coming to a close. The last thing the Democrats would want to do, and because this could affect their chances in the presidential election, is replace or fire their party chairwoman. I just don't think that's going
to
happen.
Let's move to the Republican side here, John Kennedy. Donald Trump's campaign this week hired a top Floridian, top Republican strategist, Tony Fabrizio. He was behind Governor Rick Scott's successful 2010 campaign. He's known as someone who gets outsider businessmen elected to public office. Why Fabrizio and why now for Trump 2016?
Well, Fabrizio is a pretty skilled guy, and he has worked on the national scale. He divides his time pretty much between Washington and Fort Lauderdale, and has worked for Republican presidential candidates going back to Bob Dole, and so he's got some pretty good credibility on a national scale.
He even played a role in the 1988 infamous Willie Horton ad, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. He goes back
Bush
even
Dukakis,
further.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
So he's been around for a good long time. But for Scott, he was very significant. He was the guy who sort of helped make the message for Rick Scott, and I think that is going to be a similar task that he is facing with Trump.
He's been able to export that to other states, too. This wasn't just a Florida-centric success. Since then, Fabrizio has been able to export that kind of outsider, businessman, corporate approach to political leadership to other successful races, right?
Yeah, and he's back in it in Florida again this year because he's working with one of the U.S. Senate candidates who is not really an outsider, a member of Congress right now, Ron DeSantis from Ponte Vedra Beach.
Right, running for U.S. Senate, right, the Rubio
the
seat that'll
Rubio
be vacant.
Seat,
yeah. James Rosen, this campaign hire, this political strategist from Florida, is this an indication of what to expect from Trump in the fall at all, here in Florida at least, for the swing state voters?
Well, I think it shows what everybody knows, which is that Florida is one of the two or three most important states in the election. It's had that status for the last several elections, famously going back to the 2000 election. And Trump is doing very poorly among non-Cuban Latinos. Polls show that overwhelmingly. President George W. Bush made huge inroads.
Yeah.
With that group that have been eroded since then. So Trump, in order to, I think, win Florida, Trump needs to do better among Cuban Americans. There was a poll that the Miami Herald wrote an article about a couple weeks ago that showed that, in at least in Miami-Dade County, Trump is supported by, I think it was 37% of Cuban Americans, mm-hmm. and opposed by 31%, and that is the lowest in among my local Cuban Americans. That's the lowest figure that a Republican presidential candidate has polled in decades.
All this brings into this Latino vote. Tim Padgett, covering the Latino community in the Americas for us here at WLRN. The poll that James refers to did show that significant fissure in regards to the Latino support for Donald Trump. But broadly speaking, in the state of Florida, it's anyone's call right now to a different poll from Quinnipiac that talks about Trump and Clinton at 42-43% each.
Well, look, what we often forget is that in 2008 and 2012, Barack Obama actually carried not just Florida, but the Latino vote. And not coincidentally, in 2008 was the first year that the number of registered Latinos identifying as Democrat finally surpassed the number of Latinos registering as Republican in the state. In the past 10 years, and this shows you what an uphill battle Trump has in this state with Latinos. In the past 10 years, the number of Latinos registered as voters in Florida increased 61%. And during that time, the number of Latinos identifying as Democrats rose 83%. And those with no party affiliation rose by 95%. And that's significant because it shows that a lot of those erstwhile Cuban Republicans have been sort of sucked into the independent, no party affiliation ranks.
Right.
The
but
number of Latinos identifying as Republican grew by only 16%.
But the Democratic growth has also mirrored at a time that we've seen significant in-migration from Puerto Rico into the I-4 corridor, which, again, gets to this point where the Latino vote in South Florida is not monolithic as it was a generation and a half ago. It is very nuanced, as is every Democratic, every demographic vote this time of year.
Oh, yeah. And let's not forget, Puerto Ricans are already U.S. citizens.
Right.
The other wild card here is the number of Latinos, immigrants who have become citizens. You have 1.8 million registered Latinos in Florida, but you have 2.6 million eligible to vote. And a lot of immigration experts are expecting, that number to narrow between the number of registered and the number of eligible.
So, James Rosen, how is this being heard in the halls of the campaigns that are vying for Florida, but both in terms of Secretary of State Clinton, who knows Florida well, obviously, Senator Sanders, maybe not so much, and a Trump that knows it in a different way?
Well, look, everybody knows that Florida is one of the very most important states, and so everybody's going to spend a lot of time and a lot of resources. I think that Trump's hiring of Tony Rick Scott's strategist signifies that.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be, pouring a lot of resources. The one thing I'll say is that if Trump continues to – he seemed to be stepping back from it for a while, and now he's going forward. It's hard to know where he'll end up in the general election. But if he continues to talk about building a wall along Mexico, making the Mexico government – pay for it, and saying other nasty things about Mexico, he's going to just get clobbered in the Latino vote, and that's going to have a big effect in Florida.
Oh, yeah. I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing so many Latinos not just becoming registered to vote this year, but becoming naturalized so that they can vote.
Mm.
We've never seen, as the National Immigration Forum pointed out to us, they're doing a big push here in Florida. And in February alone, they saw 10,000 Latino immigrants at least take the first steps to become citizens. They'd never seen those kinds of numbers before.
I want to, John Kennedy with the Palm Beach Post, I want to bring it back to this Florida strategist that Trump hired, Tony Fabrizio, who was amongst the architects of the successful message of Governor Scott in 2010. That message was the same message that he carried forward in 2014. It got down to three things. It was jobs, jobs, and jobs. The Trump message is because it's got to be a national message, is obviously going to have to be a larger message. But how are we going to be able to see the fingerprints of Fabrizio on the Trump messaging in Florida? Is it going to be is the suggestion for Trump 2016 in Florida move away from immigration and focus on economic opportunities?
Well, there might be some of that. I mean, one of the things that Fabrizio helped Scott with early on, kind of like now, you know, in the midst of history, but Scott, as the outsider, ran against initially in 2010, ran against the state's attorney general, Bill McCollum,
right,
who had all the establishment behind him on the Republican side running for governor. And somehow Scott managed to overcome McCollum, tarring him as a, you know, establishment figure, a career politician. I think some of that traditional campaign will be what you'll hear Fabrizio tailor for Trump versus presumably Hillary Clinton. Also, then Fabrizio helped Scott run against Alex Sink, a mm-hmm. woman candidate running as a Democrat in 2010, defeated Sink, and that also was a little bit of a you know, spring training event, I guess, maybe for the national campaign here, where here you know, a rather contentious Republican nominee is running against a woman Democratic candidate who has a long history in government, or a history in government anyway.
John Kennedy.
So you might see some of those similarities. And you know, one thing that Fabrizio's firm also talks about is how we know how to win a battle when the other side is shooting back. So he's ready to fight back, evidently. That's on their website.
I think he has a willing client in the case of Donald Trump in this case as well. John Kennedy watching Florida politics with the Palm Beach Post with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. James Rosen, Washington, D.C. correspondent for McClatchy, Miami Herald, and Tim Padgett with us here at WLRN. James and Tim, stick with us. We got more to come here on the Florida Roundup. $100 million here, $100 million there. And now we're talking about serious money. It's the fight over funding to battle Zika. That's to come. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. 69 people in South Florida have been diagnosed with the Zika virus. None of those people were infected in South Florida. They caught the virus someplace else. Still, Florida is on the front line of fighting the virus and the mosquito that carries it. This week, that fight was over financials in Congress. The White House requested $1.9 billion for Zika funding, spending supported by Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio.
I support fully funding the requests made. People say the president's request. Fine, it came from the White House. But it's really the scientists' requests, the doctors' requests, the public health sector's requests for how to address this issue.
So the White House, the scientists, the public health request, $1.9 billion. The Senate this week agreed to $1.1 billion. The House okayed half of that amount, $622 million. So we'll talk about Zika and politics and funding here on the Florida Roundup. Do you support the president's full, almost $2 billion request? The House bill spending limits are in effect here. What could the local mosquito districts get from all of this? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. James Rosen, Washington, D.C. correspondent with McClatchy, Miami Herald, still with us, as is WLRN's Tim Padgett. James, first of all, what are the politics here at play? You know, with Republicans obviously in control in Congress, the Democrat in the White House, we know those politics here, but there was some interesting bedfellows at play this week with the Zika money.
Yes, this is actually a fight that's been going on now for several weeks. Governor Scott was up here, I believe it was last week, mm-hmm. lobbying members of Congress from Florida and other states. He also met with the Secretary Burwell, head of the Department of Health and Human Services. And I asked him, he had a briefing with reporters, and I asked him that, you know, his whole career has been about fiscal conservatism and finding offsets for any spending increases. And the main argument that the Republicans have made, both in the House and Senate, who oppose large amounts of Zika emergency funding, is that we need to find offsets before we approve this new money. And I asked him if he agrees with them that there must be offsets identified. And he said, no, this is different. This is an emergency. No offsets. We'll find the offsets later. And that's what Senator Rubio has said as well. So most Republicans from Florida have broken with a number of members of their party leading with Senator Rubio on this issue.
The southernmost congressman, Carlos Curbelo, Republican, joins us now here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to WLRN, Congressman. We know that you voted against the House spending bill because you called it half-hearted, short-sighted. You wanted more money. So do you support the president's full $1.9 billion request for Zika funding?
I do, and there are two main problems with the House proposal, which passed, and now we'll go to conference, and hopefully we'll get a product that is more similar to the Senate bill out of that conference. But the two problems are, number one, insufficient funding, $622 million when and this is not the president's request. This is the CDC. This is the State Department. This is the Department of Health and Human Services. The agencies that are at the at the forefront of this fight against Zika.
Senator Rubio made that same kind of rhetorical argument as well. I mean, is the labeling important here about who made the request for the $1.9 billion?
Well, I just think that when they say, for example, Obama's request, it makes it seem like it's something that's personal to him, when it's really experts all across the government who are submitting these requests to the White House, and the White House just passes it on to the Congress.
Which would be similar for any request that came through the White House to the administration, that the agencies were requesting this funding. It's not specific to Zika is what I'm saying, right?
That's exactly right. And then secondly, the other issue I have, and I told some of my colleagues that I thought was probably the most irresponsible component of this House bill is that the funding expires on September 30th. So they make the argument, well, it's $622 million plus the $589 million in leftover funds from Ebola. But the language makes those funds expire on September 30th. So we have a situation or a potential situation where this response to the Zika virus could be interrupted. And that's just totally unacceptable. I understand maybe congressmen from other states up north don't feel the sense of urgency that we do, but we're the tip of the spear here. My district specifically is the district that's closest to the region of the world where this virus is wreaking havoc today. And we have over 100 people with this virus in the state of Florida. This is a big problem. We need to make sure that the government's response is fully funded. And you know what? If we have funds left over at the end, that's wonderful. We can redesignate, repurpose those funds for something else.
Congressman Carlos Curbelo along with us. Of course, all the other congressmen, Congressman Curbelo, are north of you. You are the southernmost congressman, of course, in the United States House of Representatives. If presumably there's going to be some money for Zika funding, what can local mosquito districts expect to get here in South Florida, in Palm Beach, Broward, Dade, and, of course, the Monroe County District?
Yeah, well, all of these local governments are seeking, and I apologize, I'm in downtown Miami, and there's a lot of construction going on here, so if it's loud, I'm sorry. But all of these local agencies are asking for help because they know that down here in South Florida, we are, for all intents and purposes, the capital of mosquitoes, and we are now entering the summer season, which is also mosquito season for us. So they're asking for additional resources so that they can respond. And it's not just mosquito control, but it's really all our health departments and local hospitals who are handling these patients and doing everything they can to diagnose people and then prevent them from passing along this dangerous virus. So it's mosquito control. It's hopefully developing a vaccine. It's treating people who already have the virus and preventing the spread of the virus.
Congressman Curbelo, this is Tim Padgett at WLRN. And I wanted to ask you if you think the tenor of the discussion might change a little bit now that the Center for Disease Control this morning issued a rather striking report that almost 300 pregnant women in the United States are being monitored as perhaps being infected with the Zika virus. And that, of course, then leads us to the frightening concerns about microcephaly, that very heartbreaking condition where newborns are born with reduced head and brain size. It's a terrible birth defect. The fact that we are seeing 300 perhaps pregnant women in the United States now, half of them in Puerto Rico, but half of them in the mainland United States, is that something that could perhaps make you know, these politicians in these regions north of us perhaps take a harder look at the urgency of this?
Look, I hope it doesn't take for an American baby to be born with this disease, with this condition, for people to act. And that's what we've been trying to impress on the rest of my colleagues. And I commend Florida colleagues like Ileana Ross-Layton and like Vern Buchanan of the Sarasota area for really trying to wake up the Congress to the women for unborn babies. It should not take that kind of tragedy to watch one of these babies, like we've seen images from Brazil and other countries. It shouldn't take that for us to do the right thing.
Congressman Curbelo, let me ask you about you said that $622 million approved by the House was not enough money. The administration's request was $1.9 billion. Presumably there's going to be a number somewhere in between those that comes out of conference committee. What's a floor? What's a minimum number that a Congressman Curbelo can support?
Now, I'm hoping we can get at least $1 billion. And it would alleviate some of my concerns if the funds would not expire. Right, the government's fiscal year ends on September 30th. As long as the funds don't expire, I think that would be a good compromise. Because what I really worry about is an interruption in the response, which would be totally unacceptable. Now, if the funds don't expire, we can always come back and approve additional funds in the future as funding starts running out. But to set up a cliff for the Zika response effort seems just completely unacceptable to me. And at the same time, I want people to think that our government isn't responding to this threat today. We are. The administration is using those $589 million in Ebola funding, which I supported the decision by the administration to do that. So the effort is being fully funded today. But we just want to make sure that that continues going into the future.
Congressman Carlos Curbelo, Republican from South Florida, the southernmost district, with us here on the Florida Roundup. Congressman, thank you so much for your time here.
Thank you all.
I want to put it back to James Rosen, Washington, D.C. correspondent with McClatchy Miami Herald. James, you heard the floor that the congressman wants, $1 billion, pretty close to what came out of the Senate. Is that possible here?
I'm not sure they'll get $1 billion. The way these things work is that the House appoints a few representatives, the Senate appoints a few senators, they go on a conference committee and they try to come up with a compromise bill. And on these funding measures, it's usually pretty close to in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
If that happens here, you'd be looking at something like $850 million. Let's round it up to $900 million. My guess is that's what you would be looking for. And I think that, unfortunately, President Obama, although he threatened to veto the House bill at $622 million, I think if it comes in at $900 million, my guess is he'll sign it and he'll continue to pressure Congress to provide more.
Finally,
money.
James, I just have to ask you about the calendar of this, because I know you're in Washington, D.C., still enjoying early springtime. But for those of us here in South Florida and trying to barbecue, Padgett, I don't know about you, in my backyard, their mosquitoes are already out there and we're swatting them away at sundown already.
No, I just got a new Weber.
Yeah. So how fast could this come out of conference committee and into the president's desk?
Well, I mean, one thing that kind of mystifies me is I'm from Michigan, and people from states like Florida, you know, don't think that Michigan gets hot and humid and mosquito-y in the summer. And let me tell you, from growing up there, it does.
Yeah. I'm from Indiana, I know.
Yeah. And there's no Michiganders that come down to South Florida in the late spring, early summer either, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And the top CDC officials and NIH officials that I've talked with say that Zika could spread to 30 states. And if you look at the map of where this spread could occur, it's a blanket across the southern United States.
We just have a few seconds left here, James. What about that calendar? You think before July 4th?
July 4th for the million, billion, if that's what it is, yes I think it'll happen before
July 4th. We got to leave it there. James Rosen, Washington, D.C. correspondent with McClatchy Miami Herald. Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us from WLRN. Our apologies to Jim Wiss with our colleague and our partner, the Miami Herald in Caracas. We were going to discuss Venezuela. We ran out of time with the congressman's comments there. So our apologies once again to Jim Wiss. We will return to that issue early and often here on WLRN. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. It's produced by Gina Jordan and Alicia Zuckerman. Our program director is Peter J. Meritz, and our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson.